Thursday, July 18th. Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
My name is Avi Wolfman Arendt. In the Enquirer today, there was a story about a new venue in the city of Philadelphia that hosts solely micro weddings.
Oh, I think micro I saw that.
Well, I think only like 16 people can fit into the venue. I think it's called Elopement something.
But they're inexpensive, like $1,000.
Micro weddings are the trend, and this is the first time I've been a trendsetter because I had a micro wedding.
You did?
I'm so proud to announce I finally become a trendsetter, Cherry Gregg, and I'll just take your round of applause. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm going around, too.
Speaking of not micro weddings, but macro weddings, the political union of Donald Trump and J.D. Vance would have seemed almost impossible 8 years ago, but it was cemented last night when Vance gave his speech as he becomes officially the Republican nominee for vice president on the ticket with Trump. So this hour is mostly about J.D. Vance.
Yeah.
Who is he? What does he believe? And what does his selection say about the future of the GOP? And our big question this hour, Cherry, to our listeners, what's your impression of J.D. Vance?
Yeah.
What's your impression of him? What do you think this says about the future of the party, the future of the country? 39 years old. Yeah. What's your impression of J.D. Vance?
Yeah, and I'm already getting a couple comments on Facebook. A lot of people don't know very much. And so what do you want to know as well? But what is your impression of J.D. Vance? The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And Avi, people should care because if Trump were to win in November, J.D. Vance would be the second in command.
Heartbeat and away.
A heartbeat away from the presidency.
So before we get into that conversation, Cherry, let's get into our trio of local news stories to kick off the program, as we always do. Start us off, Cherry.
Yeah, well, the tug of war within the DNC continues. There had been this plan to do a virtual roll call on July 21st.
3 days from now.
Yeah, that would nominate President Joe Biden ahead of the actual Democratic National Convention. It would lock him onto the ticket. But word that a group of Democrats were planning to send a letter asking the party to delay that plan leaked. So the party ultimately postponed that roll call. Now, let me tell you what this letter said.
Sure.
Well, the letter called the virtual roll call a terrible idea. And it went on to say that ending the debate over whether President Joe Biden should step aside as the nominee would, quote, deeply undermine the moral and unity, the morale, excuse me, and unity of the Democrats. Those group of that group included Democratic California Congressman Jared Huffman and Pennsylvania Congresswoman Susan Wild. She was going to sign that letter. And they ended up pulling that letter and never sent it. But, you know, Congress.
So the letter was never sent. Never sent. The threat of the letter.
Because it leaked.
Got it.
Exactly. And so why does all of this matter? Well, it shows that the party is still divided over whether President Joe Biden should remain the nominee. Now, they cannot remove him. He would have to step aside willingly.
Right.
But we've been watching the news. You've been watching the news, Avi. We know this is a question that keeps coming up. And right now, the president is dealing with COVID. He was diagnosed with COVID. He's been isolated. You know, there are reports about that. And so, again, people keep asking, what would it take for him to step aside? They keep asking him. He is says so far still that he is not stepping aside.
Yeah, you said he's isolated.
Yeah.
Because of this COVID diagnosis in Delaware, right?
I believe. In Delaware.
Maybe going to make a history-defining decision while in isolation here in our region. So we're all watching for that. I get the sense that some people think that this mounting pressure is somehow like a media pile-on. Like that's what's kept the momentum of this going. And I just think, I don't know what you think about that, but I think this is pretty organic. I think a lot of people saw the debate and their concerns were amplified. Voters saw it, and their concerns were amplified, and that the media is more sort of reflecting that than it is creating this. And maybe that is starting to dawn on the president. But yeah, there started to be some leaks. There started to be some word. We don't, you know, you never know. This is crazy season with leaks and reports and anonymous sources.
I mean, everybody's
right.
Leaking.
So you never really know what's true. But look, we know he's in isolation and he does appear to be thinking about this right
now. And I want to do the Inquirer did a little bit of a temperature check of the Pennsylvania representatives and the folks, the Democrats so far supporting Biden. Senator Bob Casey, Congresspersons Madeline Dean, Brendan Boyle, Dwight Evans, Mary Gay Scanlon, and Chris DeLuzio, all issuing statements of report of support.
Those are the locals.
The ones that seem unclear. Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, Congressman Matt Cartwright, and Congresswoman Summer Lee. So,
well, we talked about unions at the top of the show. Unlikely unions. Joe Biden's a big union guy. I'm just going to say union a bunch because our next story is about the Philadelphia Union match last night. Now, toward the end of the match, the team subbed in a new player. That's not particularly notable. They're subbing guys in all the time. But this player's name is Kevin Sullivan. Mm. And he is, I'm not making this up, 14 years old.
Like 1-4.
1-4. Here is the sound from the broadcast as he checked into the game.
His job is to be a 14-year-old kid. It's not some gimmicky thing to get headlines or sell tickets. This kid is ready. And Kevin Sullivan, the history maker, now enters this arena.
The youngest player ever to appear in a regular season game in a major North American pro sports league. Not just soccer. Youngest ever. He's 14 years old. Long way to go. But this kid could be the next great American soccer star. He's already planning to go to this huge English club when he turns 18. Arguably the best club in the world. He's only 14 now. And he doesn't just play for the Union, Jerry. I mean, this is a real Philly story. His dad and his dad's family is from the Bridesburg section of the city. Grew up in Norristown. His brother's already on the Union, his older brother. You know, of course, he's 14, so the older brother's not even that old. The mom is an attorney here in Philly who played soccer at Penn. The dad played soccer at Penn. I mean, it is like a true Philly soccer story. And there's a possibility that someday this kid is a global superstar. Kevin Sullivan.
Let me just tell you.
Are you excited?
You are, clearly. And to all the soccer moms who spend the year, their kids do 10 months of soccer, and they're going to games, spending all day Saturday, sometimes on Sunday playing soccer. Mm-hmm. This is like the dream, right? Mm-hmm. That your kid can, you know, make their dreams come true. And doing it at 14. And you know what I started thinking about? The NBA.
What, you were doing at 14?
No, I was not doing this. I did play basketball, though. Oh, yeah. I did play basketball. But I think about the kids from France who play NBA. Yeah. They've played professional basketball since they're 14, and they don't do that here in America. And it just wonders, I wonder if there's going to be a shift now.
Maybe.
That folks start preparing, you know, our kids earlier.
Let's shift now to our final story.
Yes. This one caught my eye because I have cruisers, parents who love cruises. And the Port of Philadelphia will become the home port for a Norwegian cruise liner beginning in early 2026. Yay!
See, this is the one you're excited about.
Yes.
Okay.
The port hasn't been a home port for cruises for more than a decade.
Yeah.
It's the nearest ones are in Baltimore and New York. I believe Atlantic City has one too. My parents leave from there a lot. And the ship will be the Norwegian Jewel. It would hold over 2,300 people, and it would travel between April and October of 2026 and make a couple of dozen stops in the city. But this could be huge for the waterfront, for the restaurants, for the hotels, because people usually come the night before. You get a hotel, you eat out, you hang out, you may stay on the way back. So this is a pretty big deal. And in 2026, it's a big year for Philly. It's the 250th anniversary of the country. It'll be the World Cup. We're talking about soccer today. The MLB All-Star Game. 2026 is about to be lit.
It's about to be lit. And there's going to be a cruise ship. I've never been on a cruise.
You got to go.
I am curious. I'm kind of morbidly curious about cruises. Sort of like I want to observe how it works. I don't think it's the type of vacation for me. However, I think I would go on a cruise in Alaska because I've never been to Alaska. Yeah. So at least I'm going somewhere new while I'm doing the cruise thing. Mm-hmm. And I'll also say that we have discussed privately, just doing a whole show about the waterfront.
We really
because
should,
because it is
yes.
changing so rapidly. There's big plans for the waterfront. And this could be another hook to do that show.
Yeah.
I wonder if people are... The Delaware River waterfront is so underutilized,
it
right?
Is.
It's sort of like
is.
Post-industrial. There's some stuff down there, but it's not really walkable.
And it's been changing. There's so much construction going on.
So much.
New homes, new condos, all this stuff. Oh, yeah. So I definitely think we should talk more about that.
And you're a cruise, you are a cruise person. You
I've gone on a couple of cruises. I won't call myself a cruise person, but I could see myself in years to come getting back on a cruise.
I could see it being fun. And I definitely could see it being more fun now that I have a little kid and like an easy form of travel does start to appeal more and more.
And there's so much for them to do. Kids.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, if you're going to Kid Cruise, I mean, and by the way, Norwegian, you should invite Studio 2 crew over for a tour when y'all like hook it
Are
up.
Are you asking for a bribe here?
I'm just saying, I said a tour.
Oh, a tour. Okay,
a tour.
Got it. Yeah, because everything's above board here.
Absolutely.
That's a ship term.
I said a tour.
That's a ship term. Everything's
I just
want to
look around and
board.
Open some doors and drawers.
Okay, so let's get into the big topic today, Cherry. J.D. Vance.
After
the break, we're going to talk about the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party. Our big question today is, what's your impression of J.D. Vance? And we've got some comments already pouring in. Studio2@whyy.org is the email address. The number is 888-477-9499. And we will end this segment with a little Love Cruise.
I love this.
Love Boat. Love Boat.
Got to swing.
Love Boat music.
Side
All
to
right.
side.
My apologies to the 1970s. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next? The Love Boat
promises something for everyone.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Benard.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Last night, J.D. Vance took the stage at the RNC in Milwaukee as former President Trump's vice presidential nominee.
To the people of Middletown, Ohio, and all the forgotten communities in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and every corner of our nation, I promise you this. I will be a vice president who never forgets where he came from.
The 39-year-old Ohio senator laid out his personal story, his Appalachian upbringing, which many people know from his best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, that was also turned into a movie.
And with his Rust Belt roots, he spent a lot of time talking about issues affecting working Americans, how Wall Street barons, global trade, and President Biden's policy have hurt them. But even with a popular book and film, many voters don't know that much about J.D. Vance, who was once a never-Trumper. So to fill us in on his biography, the evolution of his ideas, and why Trump picked him, is Andrew Tobias, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, what do you want to know about J.D. Vance? What do you think J.D. Vance's selection says about the future of the GOP? Did you watch his speech last night? What did you think? Email us, studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 888-477-9499.
Comments already pouring in. I want to start by reading an email from Nick that sets up our first question. Nick says, I read J.D. Vance's, quote, autobiography when it first came out. The overall reaction that I had was that it simply did not ring true. It was more like yet another attempt to join the poorer-than-thou bandwagon loved by too many politicians. It's no surprise that he's been chosen as a running mate for a candidate not known for total honesty. That's Nick's perspective, and Andrew, I want to say that because you set us up with that, because I think a lot of people look at Vance's backstory and they kind of just don't buy it. So what is his backstory? Where's he from? And help us maybe sort truth from semi-fiction here.
Well, it's interesting. When his book came out, it was broadly received positively. There's a negative reaction it got too from people I know in Ohio that we can get into more if you want. But it's interesting that sort of the context today, which is he's obviously a now a leading figure in the Republican Party versus back then, which he was basically an unknown. People are just going to kind of form different conclusions about where they think he's coming from and, you know, what his backstory is. So I can't say that I've thoroughly investigated everything in the book. I read it when it came out, but actually have not read it recently. But generally speaking, his story is that he grew up in Middletown, Ohio, which is outside of Cincinnati. It's a manufacturing center. He has family ties in Eastern Kentucky, which is sort of the basis for the Appalachian mantle that he claims. And he described being raised in poverty, in sort of, I guess, lower middle class, sort of on the bleeding edge of being poor, domestic violence, his mother being an addict, being married multiple times. When the book came out, I'll say too that he eventually joined the military in the U.S. Marines, went to Ohio State, graduated a year summa cum laude, went to Harvard, Yale Law School. And so just a real kind of bootstrap story that he has to tell. So, I mean, one of the interesting things about his Senate campaign in 2022 was that a super PAC that was supporting it published, and it's called an opposition research report. And it's essentially the kinds of research that political campaigns do on candidates to try to identify vulnerabilities and things that can be pitched to the media when they're running and stuff like that. And in that report, it never really punched holes in the fundamental story of his life. So I'm not saying that it's not possible that something in there is going to be found not to be true. I've not seen anything substantially like that come out in the year since it was released. Possibly the current environment will lead to a flurry of people coming through his life with a fine-tooth comb. But yeah, that's the general trajectory. A lot of people, including myself at the time, read the story, thought it was inspirational. It's interesting to me that we often see as a playbook in the politician kind of sphere that they'll release a book and people will kind of see it as a way to launch a career. But I'll say that people didn't perceive the book that way when it came out.
Yeah.
A lot of the focus was the interesting personal story. There was some interest among particularly kind of like more educated people in other parts of the country who wanted to understand why Donald Trump was appealing. It's hard to almost put ourselves back where we were 8 years ago, but you know, Trump really caught people by surprise in a lot of corners, and this became a popular way to interpret it. So it's just, like I said, I mean, it's remarkable that the book was released in that manner. It wasn't seen as like a political manifesto or anything like that, but clearly kind of in retrospect, you can see how maybe it was one.
Mm.
Yeah. I saw the film, and, you know, and this was years ago before I knew about his political trajectory, and sort of, I still wondered, how did he jump from, you know, going to Yale Law School, right, to becoming a politician, you know, known enough to be put on the ticket? What happened between the Yale Law School and now?
So I'm going to maybe miss a step or two, but after Yale, I mean, the book's release opened a lot of doors for him. So I forget exactly the sequence, but he ended up getting a job in Silicon Valley. He befriended Peter Thiel, who's a sort of a right-wing entrepreneur in Silicon Valley who's helped support Vance's political career. And it really was the book that opened a lot of doors for him. I've heard over and over again stories about, you know, I just talked to the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, this morning, who described reading the book, being impressed by the story and saying, I've got to get this guy on the phone. You know, there's a story about Steve Case, who's another tech entrepreneur who co-founded America Online, who read the book, called J.D. Vance and hired him to run a venture capital fund that aimed to bring investment to the heartland from Silicon Valley. So just the book opened a lot of doors for him. And so when it came out, he pretty quickly started making the rounds. So the book was released in 2016, and pretty close to after the election, that November, he began making the rounds in Ohio, rubbing elbows with, you know, important politicians. He pretty quickly started, I call it the rubber chicken circuit, but the speaking at the county Republican Party function as a keynote speaker. He started a nonprofit that was focused on the opioid epidemic, but it has been perceived in retrospect as a vehicle for his political career, and there's nuance to whether or not that's true. But he started laying the groundwork and being widely speculated about in Ohio as being a future candidate for office. And then, you know, he didn't run in 2018, although he considered it, and then he ran in 2021.
And won.
And then here he is.
And got
a big endorsement along the way, and a lot of people are emailing about this already.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
His relationship to Donald Trump over the years. So we want to play a compilation now. This is Vance talking about Trump over the years. Take a listen.
I'm a never Trump guy. I never liked him.
He's exploiting some of the racism that's there, but he's also exploiting people's fears. I think that he's leading people in a very dark direction, and that's ultimately what worries me the most.
I did say those critical things, and I regret them, and I regret being wrong about the guy. I think that he was a good president.
Was the election in 2020 free and fair? Was it above board? And my answer is no. I really don't think that it was.
And Anne from Pottstown emails and says, it baffles me how someone who compared Trump to Hitler, which I believe was in a text message exchange, compared Trump to Hitler, could now be his running mate. So many other never Trump politicians have gone to the dark side. Bernie agrees. Bernie says Vance got it right when he described Trump as America's Hitler. Why don't you explain to us his evolution on Trump? And can you try to answer the question of whether you think it's genuine or it's just opportunism?
Sure. So I just kind of skimmed past that because I think it's maybe one of the things people know about him. Maybe I took it for granted. But parallel to him making the rounds, kind of getting attention from the book when it came out, he ended up having a lot of cachet as a conservative from the heartland who, you know, quote unquote, the heartland, who could explain Trump's appeal, but then also he was booked frequently as a conservative, critic of Trump, and almost like made his name in politics as an anti-Trump Republican. And so it was gradual. It's hard to really pinpoint. You know, I've looked at a lot of his talks and speeches between kind of like 2017 and then 2021 when he emerged as this kind of MAGA Republican Senate candidate, but. What he has said, if you ask him about it, is that when Trump ran for office, he doubted his sincerity, that he actually would help the people that J.D. Vance says he cares about, which is people in the communities like the place where he came from in Appalachia and stuff like that. And over time kind of saw that the kinds of things that he didn't said kind of aligned with what Vance kind of thought would be helpful. So then, you know, one can kind of think about how much of that is a political calculation where you see in, you know, you want to run for office as a Republican. Donald Trump is the sort of entrenched leading figure in the Republican Party. Is it viable to try to run for office, you know, and say the kinds of things that he said about him in 2016? But I also think that there's, you know, like a rational basis that when he talks about this, that it sort of makes sense in this from the standpoint of, you know, the explanation that I offered. And so I kind of think the truth might be somewhere in the middle. You know, J.D. Vance is somebody who has a really deep intellectual reservoir. And for kind of like some of the depth that he talks about, some of the things he says he believes, it's, you know, it would be difficult for it to just be totally like an artifice or construction. But anyways, that's just like one of those questions that people can ponder and draw their own conclusions. And I'm not sure there's like a definitive answer that I can offer.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Carol, who says, I think Vance would do or say anything to get as much attention as possible. Besides being a Silicon Valley hedge fund manager, not someone who actually supports blue collar areas of Ohio. That's part of what Carol had to say. I want to, you know, to dig in a little bit into Vance's policies. A lot of folks may not know where he stands on various issues. And so, Andrew, could you just go down? How does he line up when it comes to Trump on conservative policies?
So I think the things that distinguish the two of them really among different kinds of Republicans, there's sort of the one prong is Ukraine is an issue and kind of America's role in the world. You know, Trump kind of came on the scene as doubting America's support of NATO, whether other European countries should do more to kind of support the cost of doing that. And there's this whole core tension between like the post-World War II order and sort of this like isolationist argument. And Vance is a leading figure arguing against support for Ukraine. And it kind of posed political problems for him because there's a major Ukrainian population in the Cleveland area. He sort of had to clean that up. I heard a lot of skepticism about him on that front when he's running for office, but at the same time it has resonated, so it's not to say that it's like an unpopular viewpoint. Another one is that Vance is a conservative who believes in government support for for industry and kind of like Trump's whole thing about tariffs and kind of economic protectionism, and the two of them are pretty much aligned on that. The third one is Vance is very socially conservative. Mm-hmm. He's dialed that down even recently with respect to the abortion issue. It's almost, I'm trying to think of like a salient example. I mean, he's argued, he's kind of criticized, and I'll just like use some of like the buzzwords that he uses, like the childless left was something that he was talking about when he's running for the Senate. He sort of argued that he cherry-picked individual Democratic politicians, said they didn't have children, and that therefore they had no stake in the future of the country, and that ended up rubbing people the wrong way, kind of like saying that,
right.
A woman's place is to be a mother is sort of like the way somebody could interpret that. Yeah. It's kind of like a hybrid left-wing, right-wing kind of viewpoint. But essentially it's kind of like open to government intervention, but through it kind of with a socially conservative
right.
Viewpoint.
Yeah, I want to play a clip to that effect. This is J.D. Vance in an interview with Tucker Carlson in 2021, and it is alluding to that place of women in society and perhaps questioning the fact that women do make decisions mm-hmm. now in our society. Let's roll that clip.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too.
Okay, so we've got a sense here from Andrew Tobias about sort of J.D. Vance's backstory. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, 888-477-9499, studio2 at WHYY.org. Trying to get your impressions of J.D. Vance, who has now established himself as clearly a national political figure. But we also want to understand a little bit about the wing of the conservative movement that he represents, people within the party that really identify with Vance. And for that perspective, now we're going to bring on Malcolm Collins, who lives outside Philly and joins us now to share his take. He's a leader in the pronatalist movement, which is trying to increase birth mm-hmm. rates. It's something that Vance has also spoken about. Malcolm Collins, welcome to Studio 2.
It is wonderful to be here with you.
So I have read, Malcolm, that you kind of separate the conservative movement into three camps, and you put Vance sort of in, do I have the right term, the techno-conservative camp? So can you
Some people call it the new right.
The new right. Okay.
Yeah, and I said, in the VP that Trump chooses this time, he's sort of choosing which faction he is going to side with and likely which faction of the Republican Party is going to succeed him. When Trumpism rose, it really represented sort of anger at the system and not necessarily a cohesive political philosophy. And it rose in opposition to what I call GOP Inc. or the old GOP. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of an alliance of big business interests and theocrats. During the Trumpist period, a new conservative faction has risen that some call the new right. I call techno-conservatism. It's people like Elon, Peter Thiel, Chamath, Vivek, David Sachs, Mark Andreessen, and J.D. Vance represents part of this. When Trump chose J.D. Vance, he sort of chose his alliance here, which I think makes a lot of sense. As big business has moved left, it sort of broke the old GOP alliance. Mm. And what Vance has done is he's urging tech elites to side with rural Appalachians, because rural Appalachians are scrappy and entrepreneurial, and they have that similar pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality.
So, but like from a policy perspective, what do you see the techno-conservatives representing? And maybe it's helpful to put this in contrast with, say, a Mike Pence. Like, what did Mike Pence represent as a VP pick versus J.D. Vance and what you see as this new alt-right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Mike Pence was very much Trump trying to shore up the old GOP Inc., the old theocratic conservative base. The techno-conservatives are quite different in what they're attempting to do. So fiscally, they're what I would call like a bull moose Republicans, and that they are somewhat libertarian, but they also believe in things like trust busting. They also believe that the government should be exercising some control over businesses that control the means of communication, which mm-hmm. governments have done historically. I mean, look at like the U.S. Post Office, for example. He also believes in pragmatic policies that help the most disenfranchised Americans, like raising minimum wage, which is one of the things you see J.D. Vance pushing. In terms of social policy, they advocate much more for family and family sovereignty, which means that they're often trying to push against what they see as progressive overreach in things like the school system. And that's where sort of their cultural bugaboos lie, which is it's different from the old theocratic part of the Conservative Party, which tried to sort of legislate morality. Now, I will say that J.D. Vance sort of cuts the difference between these communities.
Yeah, because he seems to have a foot in both worlds there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he very much has a foot in both worlds, which I think makes him a solid pick. In fact, I say the thing that makes him the worst pick is when I first heard of J.D. Vance, when I first got to know him is when I think a lot of people did, which is during his Hillbilly Elegy sort of promotion tour. And I really didn't like that person. I like who he has become, but I think a lot of conservatives, like a lot of my viewers, when I was first saying that I was excited about this pick, they at first had the same initial reaction, having not heard of J.D. Vance in a long time, and still see him as the guy who was basically apologizing for America's rural poor making a horrible decision, which, you know, many saw as sort of dehumanizing that group.
And Malcolm, I got to ask you, I mean, you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I want you to talk about the factions of this coalition that Trump is putting together for this 2024 race and how it is different than the coalition that he put together 8 years ago. And how J.D. Vance is emblematic of that.
Yeah. So the faction that Trump originally put together was entirely selling to the angry, disenfranchised Americans, or Americans who felt disenfranchised and were angry about that. And it was replacing this old alliance of big business interests and theocrats. And this alliance needed to be replaced because the big business interests had mostly become progressive and woke and DEI and all that. Mm-hmm. They were no longer really allies to the Conservative Party. So it made sense. But the problem with this initial wasn't really an alliance. It was a single base that Trump was appealing to originally. But the problem is that if you're just appealing to the angry disenfranchised, you don't have those competent technocratic people who can operate an administration. And so when he got into power, he wasn't able to implement a lot of what he wanted to implement. Well, since that first administration, I mean, if you look at the types of people that I'm talking about here, like Elon and Thiel and Chamath and Vivek and you know, even J.D. Vance, when Trump was first elected, these people were all like progressives. They were all Democrats. Like, they were all publicly Democrats. The transformation of them into conservatives has come, I think, primarily in a result of what they see as being a movement of the Progressive Party to become a party of sort of one cultural force, which is trying to homogenize American culture and trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before, just because we're running short on time for this segment, I just want to, though, ask about how this wing of the conservative movement views January 6th, the attempts to invalidate the election. Like, does that jibe with some currents within this alt-right, within the techno-conservative movement? Because Vance has clearly adopted that position, which is Trump's position. Is there, I don't know, is it, maybe it's an anti-representative democracy strain going on here? Like, is there a marriage here, or is that a place where Vance breaks from this wing?
No. I think that there is a lot of suspicion that really began with the COVID response in America to the government and large bureaucracies. And I think that many within this group have genuine suspicion over the election integrity. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they don't look at January 6th the way that somebody who believes that the election was perfectly fair. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I personally come down on this topic, but I will say that if you believed that an election had been cheated in and that, you know, we're now living in a banana republic, you are going to be more morally sympathetic to the types of people who came out for that.
Right. And isn't there sort of a monarchist camp within this group? I mean, I'm trying to catch up on this and read this.
Curtis Yarvin stuff.
Yeah, Curtis, this guy who Vance has talked about, this guy, Curtis Yarvin, is a sort of a blogger, thinker type who seems to be kind of in favor of a more autocratic type of society. I mean, is that a real thing within this wing of the party?
So I think within this wing of the party, one thing that's often talked about is we are increasingly entering a country, whether you are left or right, where one party may at one point, you know, in the next 20 years or something like that, not accept when the other party wins an election cycle or just say, I don't believe it. And, you know, I don't know what happens when that happens, but I can see why some people on the fringes are hypothesizing what a post-democratic America might look like. I personally find that idea mortifying. I think a lot of people find that idea mortifying, but a lot of us are like, but, you know, where else are we going to go? You know, with both parties becoming so distrusting of the other.
All right. Well, there's a perspective there from Malcolm Collins. We're just going to note here that there is no evidence of election meddling or any widespread evidence of fraud. But look, there clearly are folks out there within this wing of the party who have their suspicions. And Malcolm Collins laid it out for us. Thanks, Malcolm, for joining us. Malcolm Collins is a leader in the pronatalist movement, co-host of the Based Camp with Simone and Malcolm podcast, lives outside Philly. Malcolm, thanks again for the time.
Great to chat.
And we're going to go to break, but coming up, we're going to talk more about J.D. Vance, and we want to hear from you. What do you think this VP pick says about where the Republican Party is heading? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. Stick with us. Lots to come. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking about Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, talking about who he is, the evolution of his ideas, and what it signals that he is the pick for vice president. What do you think Vance means for the future of the GOP? What are your impressions of Vance? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Laura from Ambler says, my impression of J.D. Vance is of an amoral guy who completely abandoned his values to pursue power. So he's essentially Trump's mini-me. That's Laura's perspective. Andrew Tobias is with us on the line, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. And joining us now to talk about whether Vance will move the needle in a battleground state like Pennsylvania is Christopher Borick, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks so much, Avi.
And so, Chris, I watched Vance's speech last night. He played it pretty straight, stuck to the conservative talking points, was pretty charming with his meemaw stories. But he was very specific about mentioning Pennsylvania and a few other swing states. How much is the GOP locked in on winning Pennsylvania? And will Vance be a difference maker? What do you think?
Cherry, that's what I noticed, too, listening to Senator Vance's speech last night. Just how focused it was. You would think at times this was a convention for Pennsylvania. I mean, they'll throw in Michigan and Wisconsin a few times, but the most targeted place certainly is the Commonwealth right now. And I guess that makes sense given our Electoral College standing. Vance was playing to that with his rhetorical efforts, but of course his selection, I think, as Trump's running mate is a reflection of that broader goal. That's, you can get some candidate to go along with Trump that might offset some of his weaknesses in terms of perhaps age temperament, and maybe follow a nice, you know, complementary asset, but most certainly could appeal to some of the voters in a place like Pennsylvania that is so crucial. And so will Vance be able to do that? Will any vice presidential nominee really be able to deliver? The large answer empirically is no. They don't have that much of an impact.
Yeah.
But it's like Pennsylvania, which is so on the margin, as we've seen in 2016 and 2020, all the marginal things matter. Maybe Vance an impact.
Well, go ahead.
And I wanted to ask, what about swing voters? Because, you know, Pennsylvania is always within just a few thousand votes. It has been in the last couple of elections, to either side. So how could Vance impact those swing voters?
Yeah, that's the key, Jerry, right? Is does he have any impact on maybe swaying a few voters, bringing a few voters out that might not have been there for Trump? And as I said before, I think a lot of the past empirical evidence suggests not all that much, but not all that much matters in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, just a few thousand.
Of who we are. And I think his greatest asset, and this is generally shown for vice presidential nominees, is can they be the advocates? Can they be, you know, we always think, well, do they offset based on geography, gender, age, liabilities of the top of the ticket? And the reality is not all that much. What they do have in terms of success is that partnership where they're able to speak for the presidential nominee in a way that really bolsters and has some synergy with them. And I think Vance, of course, has some opportunities to do that in this particular election, given how he aligns with Trump, at least now.
Yeah, you mentioned his age. He's 39 years old. And I want to bring in a comment here from Chloe Mastor, president of the Turning Points USA chapter at the University of Pennsylvania, 18 years old, studies history at Penn, registered to vote here in PA. And this is what Chloe had to say about the pick.
I really do think that Vance compliments Trump really nicely, but MAGA, you know, Trumpism can't exist without Trump. And when you think about it, like, this whole movement began nearly a decade ago when Trump entered politics pretty much on a whim. He just ended the whole arena of political dynasties and all those nerds on the debate stage. To think of people like Jeb Bush, even just by short-circuiting the discourse.
So you mentioned that younger people might be pulled in by Vance, but let's talk about some downside here. Pierre from Westlawn says he's a real right-winger, particularly around his stance on no exceptions on abortion for incest and rape. Beth says, my biggest concern with Vance is his ideas around no-fault divorce, abortion, and child-free women. He appears to be a danger to women. Could that be a weakness in Pennsylvania, Christopher Borick? Because this is a state where I would imagine most voters believe at least in some level of access to abortion without even getting to the no-fault divorce stuff.
Yeah, these are weak spots for Vance, I think, in making an appeal. You were talking about swing voters or middle voters in the state. And you've seen Trump himself try to moderate the party's positions on reproductive rights issues. And he recognized that it is a weakness for the party. And certainly when you add Vance and some of his statements on reproductive rights issues and the no-fault divorce and some of these cultural issues, you do enable Democrats to really make a case that, look, this guy's extreme, just like Trump is, and maybe even a little bit more so. So it's one of those things that I think Trump has to navigate and did when he made the pick, that this might be something that he gets called on as he tries to maybe find a position that's a little bit more aligned with the center on an issue like this. And that's again, one of the liabilities that I think Vance does bring to the ticket.
Yeah. The other liability I was thinking about is the Vance pick doesn't really broaden the coalition. Because usually you pick someone who would bring in a group, like a minority group, maybe a woman, right? But he sort of doubles down on a group that seemingly already supports him. And your thoughts on that?
I think that's right, Jerry. I mean, this is basically a solidifying, right? A build on what you already have. Of course, there's the age difference, and that could be an asset as you try to expand, you know, your imagery of not just being an older generation. But largely on policy issues, kind of on cultural positions, on those matters, it's not a big break. And it certainly doesn't get you, you know, maybe reach into audiences that you might not already have. But I think this is part of the overall desire for a vice president, not so much to bolster those demographic weaknesses or serve as a complement there, but to serve as a complement in terms of the campaign trail and alignment, to be there, you know, 100%. So there's no question if there's a uncomfortable nature of there between the candidates. And I think that's what Trump was really seeking to build here. You know, he's from Ohio. He could speak to some of these demographics we're talking about, but largely that he feels comfortable and that we'll have someone that will be certainly there to back him up all the way in a full-throated manner.
I want to read in a few more comments. Patricia says the real hero of Hillbilly Elegy is Vance's sister, who stayed in Ohio and took care of her mother and her own family while he conquered the world. Mm-hmm. Chris from East Hampton, New Jersey says Vance is a Marine and loyalty is key, but I feel like he's thrown his loyalty to Trump, turning his back on the rest of us. He's become a mercenary. And Betty from Ringo's asks, many of us have come from single parent homes like me, but I want to know what bills in Congress he's put forth that show he really cares about struggling families. And I want to bring Andrew Tobias now back into the conversation, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. You mentioned earlier that he said that Vance says his sort of Trump transformation was seeing what Trump did as president and how he actually took care of struggling people. But you know, on the economic front, one of Trump's biggest accomplishments was just like a big tax cut. So it's kind of hard for me to understand what Vance is talking about when he references Trump's record. I mean, can you help me understand, you know, what Trump's done or what Vance has stood for that would really speak to the working class, Andrew?
So as far as what he would point to in Trump's record, I think, yeah, certainly actually, and Malcolm, the previous guest, did a much better job than I ever could of articulating the views of kind of the new right. But one of the things that they actually talk about is they view the old Republican Party as seeing the solution as everything to a tax cut, as a tax cut. And that's kind of like a pejorative way they describe sort of that vein of conservative thought. So, but what Vance, I think, views as Trump's success includes reorienting the sort of America's position relative to international entanglements, tariffs on, you know, countries like China, being skeptical about sort of the balance effects of, you know, international free trade and, you know, outsourcing manufacturing to places like China. So I think that's what he would point to. And then as far as legislative stuff that Vance has done in the Senate, so he's not been in office for very long, and so nothing that he's sponsored that I know of has passed. You know, the Senate moves pretty slow. It's very tightly you know, split. Democrats control things. But something that's notable is that he worked on a rail safety bill with Ohio's other senator, Democrat Sherrod Brown, in the aftermath of the derailment here last year that I imagine
East Palestine.
And so, I mean, it's just like the politics on its face of, you know, Vance sort of helping deliver a potential legislative win to a vulnerable Democrat is interesting in and of itself. But you also see him co-sponsoring bills with Democrats on things like bank regulation and things like that. So when it comes to economic issues, there's sort of some alignment that he has, that he has with some Democrats. But I'd point to the rail safety bill as a thing that he's made a big priority. It hasn't passed, but he spent a lot of time on it. And it's just like an interesting thing about him.
Yeah. Ruth from Brookhaven emails, I think Vance is a hypocrite. He claims to be from Appalachia while proposing all kinds of programs that would do harm to those people he claims to love so much. His book is famous, but when read carefully shows that he feels superior to those folks while he uses his origins to gain Republican points. We only have a couple minutes left, but I got to ask you about his home state. You know, he says he remembers where he came from. What do the folks, you know, who are from Ohio think about J.D. Vance?
So I'm not really sure how to answer this question. There was definitely a dichotomy with him having this kind of national cachet and celebrity, and then what I actually saw when he ran for office for the first time in 2022. There was skepticism about him from Republicans who were familiar with his comments about Trump. You know, so whether it was they thought he still believed that or they doubted, you know, the sincerity of his change, you definitely heard people who thought that his portrayal of his hometown in Appalachia in general, that it was, you know, condescending, or they disputed that he's actually from Appalachia. That is a thing that people talk about. But ultimately he won. a very contested primary. He got about 30% of the vote with Trump's endorsement. But heading into November, he won by 7, which is, you know, like not a particularly close election over his Democratic opponent. But the average Republican in Ohio won by something like 17 points. Mm. And the governor, Mike DeWine, got reelected by like 22 or 23 points. Mm. So there's not like a record of strong electoral performance. I mean, he did win, and so like that's not something to take away. I mean, he's in the U.S. Senate, so he clearly got there, but it's not like he's this political juggernaut. Although something else that I've seen, though, is that he endorsed Bernie Moreno, who is our Republican nominee to challenge Sherrod Brown. I saw him stump for him, and whereas I saw kind of like this halting, you know, curiosity / skepticism when he was running for office the first time, he's definitely, in my sort of anecdotal view, consolidated the support of kind of like your rank and file MAGA Ohio Republican voter. So how that translates to a general election, much less a national general election, I'm not sure. But he's really not that experienced of as a campaigner, and so you know, I just think it's notable that he underperformed the Republican ticket here when he ran for office. Although he has a very interesting life story. He's a compelling candidate just from a you know, like an interesting biography sense. But there are questions about that.
Yeah. A lot of unknowns.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, 39 years old, not too surprising. There are a lot of unknowns. So I'm going to close the conversation out just by thanking our guests that are still with us, Andrew Tobias, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer, Christopher Borick, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Thanks to you both for your perspectives this hour.
Yeah, and thank you to everybody who sent in emails and commented on our question of the day. That wraps our show. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Andreas Copes, and John Ahrens. Adam Staniszewski engineered today's show. Kevin McCrory is the executive producer. Joan Isabella is our audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
Before I say goodbye, just thank Alicia, David, Timothy, another David, Dina, Mary, and some folks we couldn't get to this hour. Thanks so much for your comments and your emails. Cherry, what a year this week has been.
I know.
I'm Avi Wolf, the parent. We will talk to you on Tuesday.